centrifuge light. We chase a whisper in the bloodstream's night. Some two-told steady, some let it all fade afresh.
Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Glad to be here for another deep dive.
Yeah, so today I want you to imagine a scenario that unfortunately plays out in oncology clinics and maternal fetal medicine departments, like every single day.
Oh yeah, it's incredibly common.
Right, so you have an oncology patient tracking their tumor's real-time response to a targeted therapy using a liquid biopsy, or maybe a pregnant mother providing a blood sample for a crucial non-invasive prenatal test.
And the stakes in both of those cases are just incredibly high.
Exactly. So they wait anxiously for days, you know, agonizing over what the genetic results will reveal, only to get this dreaded call from the clinic saying the test failed.
Which is just devastating for a patient dealing with that kind of diagnostic anxiety.
It really is. But the reason it failed is the truly maddening part. Because it wasn't a sequencing error, it wasn't a lack of circulating DNA. The test failed because of the specific chemical coding inside the mundane, mass-produced plastic tube their blood was drawn into.
Yeah, and that biological information, the tumor fraction, the fetal DNA, it was physically present in their vein just moments before the draw.
But it was completely destroyed in transit.
Exactly. I mean, we spend so much time optimizing our next generation sequencing platforms, pushing for higher depth and, you know, better bioinformatics pipelines.
Right.
But this really highlights how shockingly fragile the pre-analytical phase of genomics actually is.
And that is the core mystery we are unraveling in today's deep dive. What really happens to your DNA in those crucial hours between your arm and the lab bench?
It's a question researchers in the pre-analytical space have been trying to definitively map out for years, honestly.
Right, because the field has desperately needed rigorous comparative data on what these different tube additives actually do to circulating nucleic acids on a molecular level.
Yeah, we've really lacked that granular data until now.
Today we celebrate the work of Gustavo Barcelos Barra, Tizian Enrique Santa Rita, Rafael Enrique Giacomo, and Lydia Freire Abdolineri from the genomics section at Sabin Diagnostico e Saúde in Brasilia, Brazil.
They have advanced our understanding of the pre-analytical phase in genomics with their open access paper titled Impact of Tube Additives on Baseline Cell-Free DNA, Blood Nuclease Activity, and Cell-Free DNA Degradation in Serum and Plasma Samples, a Comparative Study.
Wow, quite the title.
Yeah, very descriptive. And this highly revealing research was published in the journal LabMed on March 3, 2025, after being accepted on February 12, 2025.
So we all know the diagnostic goldmine that cell-free DNA represents, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, cfDNA is revolutionary.
Yeah. Whether you are hunting for circulating tumor DNA or fetal chromosomal abnormalities, the ability to isolate these rare fragments from a simple blood draw has totally transformed medicine.
It really saves patients from highly invasive tissue biopsies or risky procedures like amniocentesis.
But the problem, and really what this paper so effectively targets, is that journey from the patient's arm to the centrifuge. It's like trying to transport a delicate ice sculpture in the back of a delivery truck. If you don't have the right cooling system, it melts before you reach the destination. In this case, the cooling system is the tube's anticoagulant, and the heat melting the DNA is a mix of white blood cells popping open and endogenous DNA-eating enzymes.
That ice sculpture analogy captures the physical vulnerability of the sample perfectly, because blood is a living, highly active tissue.
Right, it's not just some static liquid.
Exactly. The moment it leaves the vein and hits the vacuum of a collection tube, it's subjected to massive mechanical and chemical stress. And if the environment inside that tube isn't perfectly optimized, you basically trigger two simultaneous disasters.
Oh boy, two disasters. What's the first one?
First, you have leukocyte lysis. The white blood cells get stressed, their membranes rupture, and they dump massive quantities of their own high molecular weight genomic DNA straight into the plasma.
Wow, so that essentially acts as biochemical static, right? Mm. Just drowning out the rare short fragments of target cfDNA you're actually trying to sequence.
Yeah, it just buries the signal under an avalanche of junk data.
Okay, and the second disaster, which I'm guessing is the active destruction of the target itself.
You got it. Our blood naturally contains nucleases, specifically DNases, whose entire biological purpose is to scavenge and chew up stray extracellular DNA.
Which in the body is a good thing, right? Like a necessary housekeeping function to clear out cellular debris and prevent autoimmune reactions.
Exactly. It's great inside your body. But inside a collection tube, those endogenous DNases become the enemy. They immediately start hunting down and degrading the very cfDNA fragments the lab needs to analyze.
Now, I feel like anyone working in a modern clinical lab will point out that we do have specialized tools for this. You know, tubes like Streck or PayAsGene are specifically engineered with proprietary preservatives to lock down those white blood cells and inhibit the nucleases.
And they do exist, and they are fantastic pieces of engineering, but let's look at the reality of global clinical practice.
Right. They aren't exactly cheap.
No, they're expensive, they have specific shelf life considerations, and honestly, they simply aren't available in every clinic, urgent care, or rural hospital.
Which means phlebotomists are often just reaching for whatever standard mass-produced tubes happen to be stocked in the supply closet.
Exactly. You are looking at your standard EDTA, serum, heparin, or citrate tubes.
And we've known for a while that EDTA generally performs pretty decently for DNA preservation. But the specific comparative impact of heparin and citrate on both cfDNA degradation and endogenous DNase activity has just been a massive blind spot.
Yeah, we had anecdotal evidence, maybe some isolated observations, but the field lacked granular, real-time kinetic data.
So the Brazilian team recognized this gap, and they designed a beautifully controlled experiment to finally measure this invisible destruction.
They did. They enrolled 15 healthy volunteers. 7 men and 8 women.
Just to ensure a standard physiological baseline, I assume?
Exactly. And the mechanics of how they set this up are great, because tracking microscopic enzymes eating fragmented DNA inside a closed system requires some serious methodological creativity.
Yeah, from what I understand, they drew blood from each volunteer into all 4 tube types simultaneously. So that is a serum tube with a clot activator, a heparin tube, a citrate tube, and an EDTA tube.
Right, and that gives them a perfectly matched intra-patient comparison.
Which is huge, right? Because patient A's heparin tube is being compared directly against patient A's EDTA tube. It totally eliminates the variable of interpersonal biological differences.
Exactly, that internal control is vital. So once the blood was drawn, they raced against the clock. To establish a true time zero baseline, they centrifuged the samples incredibly fast within 10 to 15 minutes of the draw.
Wait. If they spun the blood down so quickly, how did they test for long-term degradation? Did they just leave the plasma sitting around?
Well, yes and no. The cells are gone, but the enzymes are not.
Ah, right.
The endogenous DNases are proteins, so they remain suspended in the cell-free plasma even after a hard spin.
That makes sense.
And this brings us to the most innovative step in their protocol. They didn't just extract the DNA right then, and they didn't just leave the plasma sitting on a cold lab bench.
What did they do?
They took those separated cell-free samples and incubated them ex vivo at a constant 37 degrees Celsius for a full 24 hours.
Basically simulating the exact physiological temperature of the human body.
Yes, they were deliberately providing the optimal thermal environment for those enzymes to function. The goal was to ask, if we give these nucleases 24 hours in their preferred temperature, what will they do to the DNA based solely on the chemical additive that was in the collection tube?
And to actually watch that happen, they didn't just wait and measure at the end, right? They used a continuous fluorescent hydrolysis probe assay to track the destruction in real time.
Yeah, this is a brilliant application of molecular tagging. They introduced a specific single-stranded DNA probe into the plasma. This probe has a fluorescent reporter dye on one end and a quencher molecule on the other.
Okay, so as long as the probe is intact, the quencher absorbs the light, so the probe stays dark.
Exactly. But as the endogenous DNases in the plasma encounter this probe and physically chop it into pieces, the reporter dye is separated from the quencher.
And it lights up. Every time an enzyme takes a bite, a tiny flash of fluorescence is released into the sample.
You got it. By tracking the change in that fluorescence over time, a metric known as delta Rn, the researchers could literally watch the nucleus activity curve unfold minute by minute over the 24-hour period.
So higher fluorescence means higher, more aggressive enzyme activity.
Precisely. Now that tracks the enzymes themselves. But to count the actual physical pieces of human cell-free DNA left floating in the plasma at the end of the day, they used quantitative PCR.
Carrying a highly specific sequence from the RNA's P gene, right?
Yes. The qPCR gives them the hard absolute quantification. They can calculate the exact yield of cfDNA in terms of genomic equivalents per milliliter.
So it provides a highly accurate headcount of what actually survived the 24-hour incubation. Let's unpack the findings, starting with that ultra-fast 15-minute baseline. Because before the 24-hour incubation even started, the numbers were staggering.
Oh, they really were.
Serum tubes yielded massive amounts of DNA, nearly 10 times the baseline amount seen in EDTA. If you didn't know the context, you might assume serum is the superior collection method.
But context is everything here, because in the world of liquid biopsies, a massive spike in total DNA is basically catastrophic.
Right, because that huge number in the serum tube isn't the valuable short fragment cfDNA. It is almost entirely high molecular weight genomic DNA.
Exactly. Serum tubes intentionally contain clot activators to initiate the coagulation cascade. And that cascade is a highly stressful mechanical and chemical event for the blood cells.
So the white blood cells panic, their membranes compromise, and they spill their internal contents everywhere. Serum is immediately disqualified for sensitive genomic work because it just buried the target under an ocean of noise.
Serum is definitely out. But what surprised a lot of people was the baseline data for heparin.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Even at that rapid 15-minute mark, heparin yielded roughly 3 times the amount of DNA as EDTA or citrate.
Which strongly implies that heparin itself is hostile to the cell membranes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it appears to be inducing early leukocyte lysis almost upon contact, before the centrifuge even has a chance to separate the cells.
It really does seem that way. Meanwhile, EDTA and citrate were sitting comfortably at the lowest yields, establishing what the researchers consider the true, uncontaminated baseline of cell-free DNA in a healthy, unstressed human circulation.
So the baseline data is concerning enough for heparin, but the 24-hour degradation stats are where the survival rates become truly dramatic.
Yeah, this is where it gets crazy.
After sitting at body temperature for a day, exposed to whatever nucleuses were active in the plasma, EDTA proved to be the absolute gold standard. It experienced a microscopic 8% degradation in cfDNA.
The sample was functionally pristine.
And citrate was a respectable runner-up, right? Losing about 13.3%.
Yeah, not bad.
But then we look at the others. Serum lost 55.6% of its cell-free DNA. And heparin. Heparin wiped out nearly 9/10 of the sample. An 85.3% reduction.
The enzymes just chewed it to pieces until there was virtually nothing left to sequence.
And this perfectly aligns with the real-time fluorescent probe data. In the EDTA plasma, the fluorescence curve basically flatlined instantly. The DNA's enzymes were completely paralyzed from minute one.
Right, and in citrate, the curve showed a slow, partial rise, indicating the enzymes were sluggish, but still somewhat active.
But in serum and heparin,
the fluorescence just shot up in a steep, aggressive cliff. The nucleases were operating at maximum efficiency, completely uninhibited by the tube additives.
This forces us to ask a purely chemical question, though. I mean, these tubes are all just simple plastic cylinders sitting on a cart. Their primary clinical job is exactly the same: stop the blood from clotting.
Right.
So why do they create completely different molecular environments? How does EDTA paralyze an enzyme while heparin throws it an all-you-can-eat buffet?
It all comes down to the actual mechanism of anticoagulation. EDTA and citrate belong to a specific class of chemicals known as divalent ion chelators.
Okay, chelators. What does that mean for the enzymes?
Well, to understand why that matters, you have to look at the structure of a DNase enzyme. These nucleases cannot function on their own. They absolutely require specific metal ions, primarily calcium and magnesium, to act as cofactors.
Ah, I see.
These ions stabilize the enzyme's active site, allowing it to grip and sever the DNA strand.
So they basically act like biochemical handcuffs.
Yeah.
DNase enzymes need calcium and magnesium ions to function. EDTA and citrate lock up those ions, meaning the DNA-eating Pac-Men in our blood are essentially starved and shut down.
Biochemical handcuffs is the perfect way to visualize it, and it highlights a brilliant two-for-one benefit of EDTA.
Oh.
The coagulation cascade also relies heavily on free calcium to form a blood clot. So by hoarding all the calcium, EDTA achieves its primary job of keeping the blood liquid, and as a secondary, highly beneficial side effect, it simultaneously shuts down the nucleases that threaten our genomics work.
That's incredibly elegant. And citrate does the same thing, just with a slightly lower binding affinity, which is why we saw that 13.3% degradation slip through.
Exactly. But heparin operates on a totally different chemical pathway. It ignores the calcium entirely.
Wow, it really does.
It does. Heparin is a highly sulfated glycosaminoglycan. It achieves anticoagulation by binding to and activating a specific protein in the blood called antithrombin.
Okay.
And once activated, antithrombin blocks the clotting factors. But notice what isn't involved in that process at all.
Calcium and magnesium.
Exactly. Those essential metal ions are left totally free, floating abundantly in the plasma, which means the endogenous DNases are fully armed, fully energized and ready to obliterate any cell-free DNA they bump into.
So the enzymes are completely uninhibited.
Completely. But the damage from heparin doesn't even stop there. We already established from the baseline data that it seems to induce early white blood cell lysis.
Right.
And furthermore, heparin is famously known in molecular biology circles to be a potent inhibitor of PCR amplification. The chemical structure of heparin physically interferes with the TAC polymerase enzymes that labs use to copy and test the DNA.
So if a clinic draws a liquid biopsy into a heparin tube, they're initiating a triple threat. First, the tube causes cell lysis, flooding the sample with junk DNA. Second, it leaves the calcium free, allowing nucleases to rapidly destroy the fragile target DNA.
Yeah.
And third, even if a tiny fraction of that target DNA survives the journey to the lab, the heparin itself actively jams the testing machinery trying to sequence it.
It is the absolute worst case scenario for pre-analytical sample integrity. And you know, this isn't just an abstract chemistry lesson for laboratory technicians. This translates directly to human lives and those agonizing clinical failures we discussed at the start of this deep dive.
Let's bring this back to the maternal fetal medicine ward. We know that pregnant women who have a history of miscarriages or are at a high risk for blood clots are frequently prescribed prophylactic heparin therapy.
Right, they are actively injecting heparin into their system.
And clinical data has consistently shown that when these specific women go in for a non-invasive prenatal test, a test relying entirely on capturing fragile fragments of fetal cell-free DNA, they face a drastically higher rate of non-reportable results or test failures.
Yeah, and the Brazilian team highlights a staggering statistic in their paper. One previous study found an odds ratio of 21.87 for NIPT failure in patients undergoing heparin therapy.
An odds ratio of nearly 22. That means a pregnant mother on heparin is almost 22 times more likely to get that devastating test failed phone call compared to a mother who isn't on the therapy.
It's a huge disparity.
For years, clinics just knew this was a frustrating correlation. But this paper provides the glaring mechanical smoking gun. The fetal DNA isn't missing. It is literally being chewed up by hyperactive, uninhibited DNases in the collection tube before the lab can even uncap the sample.
The clinical implications are massive here. It dictates that phlebotomy protocols must be rigidly enforced based on the downstream diagnostic intent. If a test requires cell-free DNA, heparin and serum basically cannot be anywhere near the patient.
Right.
Now, we do need to acknowledge the scope of this particular study because the researchers point out their own limitations. They utilized a cohort of 15 healthy volunteers.
Which provides a clean baseline, but it doesn't account for the massive physiological chaos you might find in a patient with advanced metastatic cancer, or severe sepsis, or complex autoimmune inflammation.
Exactly. Those pathological states can drastically alter baseline nucleus activity and white blood cell fragility. So a necessary next step for the field is to replicate this ex vivo incubation model using blood from diverse patient populations.
Makes sense.
The researchers also noted an interesting avenue for optimization. Standard citrate tubes use a 3.2% concentration, which only partially inhibited the nucleases.
Okay, so can they increase that?
Yeah, preliminary data from other investigations suggests that bumping that up to an 8% citrate concentration might actually match the protective power of EDTA.
Which could be vital if a lab faces an EDTA supply chain shortage. So taking all this intricate molecular biology, the fluorescence curves, and the chemical handcuffs, what is the ultimate takeaway from this research for the genomics community?
I'd say the choice of blood collection tube is a make-or-break factor for cell-free DNA analysis, with EDTA proving to be the gold standard by starving DNA-degrading enzymes of essential ions. Conversely, heparin and serum allow active nucleases to rapidly destroy cfDNA, making them highly unsuitable for liquid biopsies and prenatal tests.
It fundamentally changes how you view a simple blood draw. It isn't just transportation. It is an active chemical negotiation. Which leaves us with a rather profound and slightly unsettling thought to ponder long after this deep dive ends. What does this mean for all the past clinical trials and historical biobank data that unknowingly relied on heparin plasma for their genetic analysis?
It's a sobering thought. How much irreplaceable genomic history has already been quietly erased by those hungry enzymes before the vials ever hit the ice?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
In a bright room spin of the centrifuge light, we chase a whisper in the bloodstream's night. Some toots hold steady, some let it all fade. A fragile signal in a chemical shade. I hear the scissors waking up at 37. Time takes a bite, turns clean to uneven. Choose the wrong vial, watch the story unwind. Choose the right one, keep the truth aligned. Gelate the noise, the message stay. Lock down the cutters, don't give it away. Hold that spark in the plasma line. EDA, keep the data mined. EDDA, keep the data mined. Citrate can slow it, not all the way. A halfway promise that might still pay, but heparin's trouble, things break, cells spill, and enzymes feast like they've got free will. Serum looks loud, but it's not all real. Clotting confetti in the lab's reveal. 24 hours and the track goes thin, so guard the fragment where it begins. Chelate the noise, let the message stay. Lock down the cutters, don't give it away. If you want the signal, you can trust in time. EDDA, keep the data mined.